This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The results are in from yesterday's nationwide ballot and Russia, and the winner is President Vladimir Putin, which is a little odd because his name was not on the ballot in these parliamentary elections. Still, the United Russia Party, which swept into power, has no public platform beyond its support for the president, so in a way, it was Putin's day. United Russia wound up with 40% of the vote, and sympathetic smaller parties also did well, which means that President Putin should have firm control in parliament and every reason to expect re-election when his name will be on the ballot next spring. The election has its critics from inside and outside Russia. Independent election monitors say government resources were used to help preferred candidates, and they accuse the state-controlled media of blatant pro-United Russia bias. The Communist Party, a big loser yesterday, accused the Kremlin of rigging the vote. Later in the hour, we'll look at James Baker's new role. The former Secretary of State has been asked to restructure Iraq's international debt. But first, the future of democracy in Russia. If you have questions about what yesterday's election means for stability, for economic reform, or for democracy, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from our bureau in Moscow to talk about the results in a bit more depth is Lawrence Sheets. He's NPR's Moscow bureau chief. And thanks very much for staying up, Lawrence.
Thank you, Neil.
Walk us through the results a little bit. As we said, United Russia got about 40% of the vote.
Well, as you said, it was a huge victory for United Russia and President Putin, the man they support. It was a walkover. Basically, United Russia will officially have about half the seats in the new parliament. But when you consider there are a lot of independents running who support the party line, support President Putin, and the fact that President Putin can count on the support of a couple of nationalist parties who made it into parliament, he's going to have close to two-thirds support on important issues. That's vitally important. With two-thirds of the seats in parliament, you could, in theory, amend the Constitution. And one thing that people talk about here is the possibility that President Putin might like to extend his stay in office. He's up for re-election, as you mentioned, in March of 2004, just a few months from now. There's very little question that he's going to win. In terms of the Russian Constitution, at this point, the way it stands, he has to stand down after two terms in 2008. But the speculation is that there's going to be temptation for him to try to stay in office.
He said recently in London, I believe, that he had absolutely no intention of trying for any kind of a third term, but politicians have been known to change their minds on such things. But let's get back to the results from yesterday. The Communist Party, the last several elections, has been the second largest party in the parliament. What happened to them?
Well, they were undoubtedly the biggest losers since the breakup of the Soviet Union. They've relied on a very well-disciplined core of voters, about 25 to 30% nationwide in nationwide elections since the breakup of the Soviet Union. This time they got just 12% of the vote, a real washout. They were hurt by the defection and the creation of parties which basically stole their agenda. Now, what the Communist Party will say, and we heard the Communist Party, Gennady Zyuganov, saying it today, was that this election was a disgusting farce, that his party had been the victim of relentless attacks in the state media, and there's very little question that that was the case. In many cases, we saw the state media attacking the Communist Party relentlessly while promoting President Putin's party.
Anybody else emerge as a winner? Because the number two party now, at least in terms of absolute size, is the ultra-nationalist Mr. Zhirinovsky's.
Well, that's correct, and they're called the Liberal Democratic Party. Of course, they have little to do with democracy or with liberal politics. This is an ultra-nationalist party which really makes its capital out of ridiculous antics quite often. They're very anti-Western. One of the things in their platform has been in the past to the reconquest of Russia, of Alaska by Russia. Other things including promoting polygamy in Russia so that Russia can repopulate itself. They did come in third, but despite their rhetoric, Mr. Zhirinovsky, when push comes to shove, he can usually be counted on to support the Kremlin. So it was a victory for Mr. Zhirinovsky. Coming in at 11% of the vote, that's twice what they had 4 years ago. But again, they can be counted on by the Kremlin for support in a pinch.
There had been a couple of small but relatively influential liberal parties. They were also washed out.
This is one of the big stories. Two liberal parties, Western-oriented, very much these parties see Russia as part of Europe, as having to rejoin Europe, and they're very friendly, tend to be very friendly towards business. They had controlled about 50 of the seats in the old parliament, and this parliament, they failed even to pass a 5% hurdle that you need to get into parliament. They picked up only about a half dozen seats in individual constituencies, and they are just going to be not a force at all in the new parliament, completely gone. These parties had really been the driving force behind a lot of the technical language and the economic reforms which had been taking place in Russia over the past decade.
Now, remind us a little bit about how the Russian parliamentary system works. With, as you say, such a landslide, are there any checks and balances on what could be this enormous pro-Putin majority?
Well, there are, and this is a bicameral legislature. In addition to the lower house of parliament, which voters were choosing on Sunday, there's also the upper house of parliament, the Federation Council. That would have to pass most legislation, but this is a body which almost never stands in the way of legislation before it goes on to President Putin for his signature. It's made up, the Federation Council, of regional governors. Most of them are loyal to the Kremlin. Now, if we're talking about amending the Constitution, which we spoke of before, not only would you need two-thirds of both houses, but you'd also need two-thirds of the regional legislatures to approve amendments to the Constitution. Russia has 89 regions, so it sounds like a daunting task. But in reality, a lot of these regional legislatures are really stacked with Kremlin-friendly forces, so it might not be such a Herculean task in the end to amend the Constitution.
Over the past several months, there have been many people who are concerned about what they regard as increasingly authoritarian control by the Kremlin, by President Putin, the control of the state-run media, his campaign against the prominent robber barons, if you will. Is this going to do anything to allay their fears?
No, I would think that it would act as an alarm signal, and indeed we are hearing talk from the liberal parties who were roundly defeated in this election that this is going to pave the way for Mr. Putin to do just what he likes for the country. He's going to have the absolute control over the lower house of parliament, and pro-democracy forces, if you can term them that here, are extremely worried. We hear talk from the Communist Party, and not a party that one associates with dissidents, usually saying that basically a dictatorship was forming in the country. So this is going to do nothing to allay those concerns.
You mentioned earlier also the communists were, there were complaints about vote rigging and the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is a pan-European organization, complained about pro-Putin bias on the state-run media. Any other complaints about the quality, the integrity of the election?
Well, indeed, the OSCE was referring mostly to the bias in the media. It also said that the government had allowed the United Russia Party, which backs President Putin, to use government buildings, to use government resources, government money, that there had been intimidation of opposition candidates, and that the atmosphere basically was not democratic and was not fair. In addition to the international organizations, there's also a local Russian observer group. Now, the OSCE, which you mentioned, had 600 observers here. This local Russian election observer group, Voice, they had 4,500 people on the ground. They've gone much further than just talking about media bias. They say that they have evidence of considerable ballot box stuffing. So the plot thickens.
Is any of this likely to change any results?
Well, there's been no comment yet from the Kremlin, Neil, and often governments don't really respond to these types of criticisms, but having the OSCE, such a respected body, coming out and criticizing so blatantly the Kremlin has to come as a real slap in the face to President Putin. He's a man who, despite all of the allegations that he's moving towards authoritarianism, he's always a man who's maintained that he's a true democrat, that he wants Russia to rejoin and be part of the democratic family of nations. On the other hand, Russia's always had a thorny relationship with organizations like the OSCE, with European human rights organizations. Russia's been repeatedly criticized over its war in Chechnya, as we know. Its army's been accused of committing atrocities there. So perhaps this criticism on the election from the OSCE is just something that the Kremlin is going to try and ignore.
Lawrence Sheets, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil. My pleasure.
Lawrence Sheets is NPR's Moscow bureau chief, and he was on the line with us from the Russian capital. From Moscow, yes, indeed. Joining us now from her home in Moscow is Masha Lipman. She's an analyst with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Moscow Center. She also writes a column monthly for the Washington Post, and it's nice of you to join us.
Hello.
We've heard how well the United Russia Party did yesterday. Can you tell us a little bit more about who they are and what they represent?
Oh, good question, actually. They represent a few cabinet ministers, quite a few regional leaders, quite a few governors. About one-third of the Russian governors are on the list. But unlike parties in more developed democracies, this is not a party which wins the vote and then appoints its people to important positions. In fact, what happens in Russia is the other way around. This party is made in the Kremlin, masterminded in the Kremlin, and then they recruit important people, regional leaders, and government ministers. This is the party of bureaucrats, or the way it is described in Russia, the party of power. Its main slogan is, we are with the president, and its actual, if you like, issue is loyalty, conformity, and subservience to the president. They are put together by the Kremlin in order to become a legislative base for whatever initiatives might come from the Kremlin and the government, and they will certainly deliver. We will have a rubber stamp parliament this time, and as a Moscow correspondent has just said, Putin is likely to have a two-thirds majority in his parliament.
So they don't have their own manifesto, their own party platform?
No, they absolutely don't have anything in terms of program or issues or whatever, and this was written about by critics in Moscow a great deal. They are so confident of that allegiance to the president is enough for them to win a popular vote that they refuse to take part in the television debates in which all other parties participated. One of the leaders of the party went as far as say, for us to take part in these debates would be like for a world-class hockey team to play with a street team of youngsters if we take part in these debates.
Now, there is, as you also heard, mentioned that with this huge majority, there could be plans to extend Mr. Putin's time in office, this on the assumption that he will win re-election come the spring. Is this openly being discussed in Moscow?
Oh, this, of course, is being discussed, and actually this is being discussed almost as soon as Putin came to power and became president 4 years ago. He's sure to win his re-election in March, no question about it. The problem with Russia is that we have not had a single democratic change of power at the top, not yet. President Putin was anointed by President Yeltsin. This was not a democratic succession of power. He certainly stood a popular vote and won it, but he was a Kremlin successor, somebody that the Kremlin picked out and President Yeltsin called for the nation to vote for. And what Putin has done over his years in office is tremendously diminish the extent of political competition. So he is not facing any serious contenders. There is no opposition party to speak of in the strict sense of the word. And because any change of the elite sends the elite to fear that they may be prosecuted or their property will be stripped from them if any sort of an opposition comes to power, they tend to think about a succession. And this is what is likely to happen next time. At least this is the way it looks now, next time being 2008. Now, is this indeed happening? It's very hard to tell now. However, Putin, of course, said he will not run a third time, but his inner circle may push him to. And also, there are other ways, rather than changing the constitution directly to say now Putin may run a third time or the president may run a third time. There have been talks all along that if Russia is joined with Belarus and they form a new state, this is a new state, new constitution, and the two previous terms do not count.
Hmm. We're speaking with Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She's in their Moscow Center. And when we come back from a short break, we're going to be taking your calls. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We're talking about yesterday's parliamentary elections in Russia. If you have questions about what this means for the future of the former Soviet state, join the conversation. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Russian politics. Yesterday's parliamentary elections helped cement President Vladimir Putin's hold on government. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And with us from Moscow is Masha Lipman of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And why don't we get a caller on the line? And this is Gary, who's with us from Memphis, Tennessee.
Hey, Neil, great show.
Thank you.
Yes, my question is about the Constitution in Russia. You know, I don't quite understand how similar or how different is it to the United States Constitution? And specifically, do they have anything similar to a Supreme Court which interprets the laws in light of the Russian Constitution? And my last question is, does Putin have term limits?
I think we did answer that last one, Gary, that he does have a two-term limit, though there's, as we mentioned, conversations going on about perhaps changing the Constitution in that respect. But, Masha Lipman, what about the question about the is there a Supreme Court?
There is indeed something that is similar to the American Supreme Court called Constitutional Court. Constitutional Court has a checkered history. Back in 93, in time for an anti-Yeltsin coup in Moscow, the Constitutional Court took sides with the mutineers and thereby compromised its high status. Since then, the Constitutional Court has been more quiet and not so partisan, it is not so openly siding with the Kremlin. However, on important issues, there is no doubt that Constitutional Court will be obedient and will not oppose something that is important Kremlin policy. However, on minor issues, sometimes, and just recently in time for this election, when a law on the media was amended so as to limit the coverage of the campaign in the press, the Constitutional Court countered the decision of legislators and forced the legislatures to amend this law. So sometimes it may fulfill its mission, but to be sure, on very important issues, the Kremlin may count on the Constitutional Court for loyalty.
Gary, thanks very much.
Thank you, sir.
And joining us now here in Studio 3A is Clifford Gaddy, a Russia scholar and senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. And thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
What do you make of yesterday's results?
Well, I think that, as I think some of your commentators, your Moscow correspondent and Masha Lipman have indicated, this is not terribly surprising for people who have been looking at Russia. As Masha says, for the 4 years that Mr. Putin has been in power, there has been, I think, a trend towards consolidation of his personal power and the power of the people around him that people associate with the security services. There are, as pointed out, a few minor surprises in this in terms of parties that now have greater strength, and the fact that the two most notable pro-Western, pro-democracy, pro-market policies don't have official party representation, though they'll still have a few of their members there. Mm-hmm.
In situations where one party or one block of parties has a huge majority, sometimes you get situations where there's a lot of maneuvering within the bloc, and in effect they form their own opposition. Is this going to be a disciplined group of party votes that Mr. Putin can rely upon, or might there be those kinds of differences, do you think?
Well, I think he will be able to rely on these, and I don't think there's ever been any question. I mean, in effect, he's had control over the parliament since he came into office. This, I don't think the parliament has been any particular obstacle to his program as a ruler. This makes it a bit more streamlined, but it's not in that sense a dramatic change. It still comes down not to what the parties represented in parliament want and what's on their programs, but really it's a question of what is Mr. Putin's program.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Jack, who's with us from Mars Bluff, South Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Fine, thank you. I was listening to your show, and I was calling in to put a little bit of a positive spin, if I could. Even though I don't agree with the way Putin has kind of conducted an iron hand with his political opponents, at least it's better than it was in Russia when we had the Cold War and the arms race.
Masha Lipman, I don't think I'll get too much disagreement.
No, I wouldn't disagree with that. Absolutely not. And even though Putin has significantly reduced some of the freedoms, especially the freedom of the press. However, we have way more freedom. It cannot be compared with the Soviet days. We can travel abroad. We can actually read whatever we like. We can watch any movies that we like. We can go and see any art that we like. This is as far as everyday life is concerned, there is freedom in Russia, no question about it. As far as democracy is concerned, it's another issue. And, of course, again, this is much better than it was with the one-party system that was codified in the Constitution with the overall censorship, with the Communist Party ruling over everything. No comparison. However, when we talk about today, I think it is wrong to compare with the time of the Cold War. We have a much closer point of reference, and this is post-communist Russia in its early years. And with this, I think Putin's first 4 years in power have indicated regress, both politically in terms of democracy and in terms of public attitude.
Thanks, Jack, for the question.
One more thing to add. If they have a really open society in the way of news, if they can get Western media, then one way to bring about this change politically is to constantly be, you know, letting the Russian people know that they're not operating under a true democracy, and through that it will affect the leaders. They'll either have to either get stronger with more of an iron hand, or loosen up.
Okay, Jack, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Clifford Gaddy, following on Jack's point, was this a vote for a strong man, for continuity, for stability?
Yeah, I think you could say that. And I think what's, you know, one of the interesting issues is the extent to which some of the political forces, some of the parties, including these two pro-democracy parties, the Union of Rightist Forces and Yabloko, miscalculated, I think, in originally as they joined forces with Putin 4 years ago. I remember very explicitly hearing the leaders of those parties, this coming out of a time of relative chaos in Russia with a weak president, Yeltsin, who appeared in public drunk, who was simply unable to push through a solid program. And these individuals from the pro-market parties were concerned about implementing more radical pro-market economic policies. They felt that a man like Putin, who would have a stronger hand, who would consolidate state power, reestablish stability in Russia, would be a boon to them. And explicitly hearing them say, let's have 2 or 3 years of this man in power, let him consolidate the power, then we can push through market reforms, which we know are basically unpopular in Russia among many people. And I think that they miscalculated in thinking they could manipulate Mr. Putin. In fact, I believe that he's succeeded in manipulating them. And in many ways, not only this respect, but in other ways, they do have themselves to blame for their defeat this election.
Masha Lipman, I wanted to bring you in. We hear allegations from the OSCE about manipulation of the Russian media. Now, are they talking largely about radio and television? Are there large varieties of opinion available in printed media and on the Internet?
They're mostly talking about television, and television is very important in Russia as in any country, but maybe even more so because printed press has very low runs, and mostly we're talking about Moscow papers. Television is a source for information and political news for 90% of the Russian people, or maybe even more. And all television is now controlled or owned by the state. And this is one of the undoubted, quote-unquote, achievements of President Putin during his time in office. He placed much importance with this issue, and it took him a while and some effort, but now all television is under control. And on television channels, the coverage of the United Russia, the party of power, not only much more generous, but also invariably favorable, while the coverage of other parties took up much less time, and also a lot of time on the state channels, state networks, was spent on vilifying the communists because the main attack was directed against the communists, the main competitor of the party of power. And sure enough, both goals were achieved. Television is a very powerful weapon. The United Russia ended as number one in a solid majority, and communists lost about half of their vote, the vote that they had the previous time. Newspapers are very different. Newspapers, because of low run, are not of so much importance to the Kremlin, and the Kremlin puts up with them. They are at the mercy of the Kremlin, but it wouldn't, so far, wouldn't crack down on printed press. And you can find a lot of very critical opinion, very good analysis in a lot of papers. The same applies to the internet. There are quite a few very interesting and very insightful websites that cover politics and that discuss politics. However, it should be remembered that only 4% of the Russian people use the internet regularly, or internet users who depend on the internet for their news, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Radio is too not a very important factor, but we have at least one very good radio station in Moscow, popular, interactive, with a loyal audience, and it has a lot of live air, politicians talking, and journalists, and it can still afford quite a critical view.
Let's get another caller in. This is Eric, who's with us from Salt Lake City.
Yes, I had a question. I have friends and family that live in Moscow, and actually my wife's parents are deadly worried that Putin is striving to create a Soviets too, as they call it. I just wondered if you have any comments on this.
Clifford Ganny, what do you think?
Well, there are, I'm sure they're not the only ones who share those fears about a resurrection of a Soviet-style state. And in fact, I think it is fair to say that in many ways, Mr. Putin and the people around him share, to some extent, the same ends as the Soviet rulers. They disagree on the means by which the Soviet rulers were trying to achieve the ends. The ends being a strong state in Russia, a strong Russia based on a strong state, a state that takes precedence over the individual. Where I think Mr. Putin, personally, and a group of people around him that also come from the security services differ from traditional Soviet communists, is that they believe that there are lessons to be learned from the Soviet period, that there are certain things that are counterproductive, too much repression, too much coercion in the political sphere, the idea of a centrally planned economy in the economic sphere. These just didn't work. History proved that they didn't work. So we need now, they say, to find different approaches. So they share the many of the ends. They differ about the means, and this is an important difference, of course, because there is an element of democracy, there is an element of respect for democracy, an element of respect for individual and individual freedoms, and for a market economy that's in there. But it is by no means an unambiguous, wholehearted endorsement of democracy and market economy, as we perhaps would like to have believed that the post-Soviet transition was leading to.
Eric, this is your wife's family that's in Moscow, you say?
Yes.
And were you speaking with them just over the last couple of days?
Yes, I speak to them rather often.
And
her parents are actually in the process of trying to immigrate. They're so scared that the Soviet regime will return.
Well, we wish them the best of luck. Thanks very much for the call.
Yes, thank you.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Masha Lipman, I wanted to bring you in on exactly that same point. Does Eric's family have good reason to worry, do you think?
Well, it depends on, I hope they are not very rich tycoons. This way they would be in big trouble. No, I don't think what we may be facing in the future is a return of the Soviet Union. I think there is no return back. For a variety of reasons, we have big business in Russia, and not enough, but still we do have medium and small business. Business incentive, private entrepreneurship, is allowed in Russia, and this is a very important thing, and I don't think it is possible to somehow revert it back to the way it was before. We have open borders, and with big trade, with free travel, it is also impossible to take it back. These are the basic things that I think define how new, how different the system is from before. Also, Of course, I would agree that Putin's idea of ruling a country is not democratic in that he believes in one strong center of power. He either doesn't understand or strongly dislikes the idea of a variety of different interests conflicting, and the need to balance them all is way too sophisticated. He prefers the good old Soviet way in that he has one center, this is the Kremlin, all the decisions are taken there, all policies are shaped there. He has weakened all the institutions through his years in power. However, the extent of coercion is incomparable. This is a free country. If we do not talk about politics and the political competition, this is a country where a person, if he doesn't mess up with politics, is free to do whatever he likes. Even though younger generation do not appreciate it because it comes to them as natural, I'm sure if anything like coercion, like infringement on their rights happen, they will respond. The big, big achievement of post-communist years is that younger generation take freedom for granted. This is the only way they know how to live, and this is Russia, and this is quite something.
One email question before we have to go. This is from Peter Hickey. I wonder if your guest would comment on if they feel that Putin's relationship with President Bush helped, hindered, or did not affect the performance of Putin's party. Clifford Gatty?
I'm sure it played both ways with different parts of the electorate. There were some people in his traditional base of support that were a little bit dubious about the close relationship with the United States and the seeming endorsement of certain U.S. policies. On the other hand, I believe that many Russians, Masha should speak as a Russian better than I can, but many of the people I know felt that Putin's relationship with Bush was, in some extent, a legitimizing of him as a world leader. And that is something that they all hoped Russia would have, and they like the idea that Russia has an individual at the helm who is not a laughingstock, as in some cases Mr. Yeltsin was, but a respected leader.
Masha, if you could, we just have about a minute left, but I would like to hear your thoughts on that.
I don't think President Bush had anything to do with the victory of United Russia Party. However, what it did have to do is the attitude of the world toward the war in Chechnya. This is one of Russia's worst problems. The war has gone on. This is the second war has gone on for almost years now, and before the world was critical and Putin had at least to be aware of that, there was criticism of it. After September 11, all this criticism subsided, and I think the person who masterminded this new policy toward the war in Chechnya was President Bush, because Putin suddenly became a partner in the war against terrorism, and Chechnya didn't matter. And this is really bad. And talking about the Russian press, for instance, this position of the world helped Putin bar Chechnya from the cover, bar the press from covering Chechnya. There is no Chechnya on television.
Masha Lipman.
There hasn't been any news about Chechnya.
Masha Lipman, thank you very much for being with us. She's an analyst with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Moscow Center. She was with us from her home in Moscow, and Clifford Gatty here with us in Studio 3A. Thanks very much. We appreciate your time today. We'll be back to talk about James Baker after the break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.